Welcome to Sweat, Tears, and Equity, a podcast by Fortech Investments, where we discuss the untold truths of funding and funding startups. Our guests are founders, investors, and other players from the ecosystem who learn these valuable lessons the hard way. They share the things that they wish they knew earlier about the challenges that lie in this journey, the things that no one prepared them for, so you and other founders can navigate this bumpy road successfully. So Bogdan Nicoara is the CEO and founder of Bright Spaces. It was really cool that I heard how many times you actually tried to do business in terms of projects, because I've heard that you started since high school.
Yeah.
And during your, journey, you actually managed to come into more than 20 projects. And for me, that was like really interesting and cool, because you need to be truly resilient and you need to believe in your vision. And what I wanted to understand is how do you keep that mindset of overcoming, you know, struggles, and run through 20 projects until now, until Bright Spaces. It just amazed me.
First of all, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to try to share relevant stuff with other people. But I'll be blunt with answering this. I had no idea what I was doing. So throughout those 24 projects, the first ones were obviously done because I like being involved into different kind of activities that were different and more engaging than the usual school and going out. Plus, I realized quite early, it was 14, 15 years old, when I realized that you could do something that brings someone value and you can get money out of that. My parents were both employed at that time. So it wasn't something that I got from my family, but their attitude was always that of doing more. So they were really, they were and are my examples, because they always tried to do their job at the best with the best possible outcome. And I realized that, okay, that can work perfectly if you're employed and get a good career out of that. But what if you do it directly? So you take out the intermediaries, sort of. So I started doing really, now seems silly stuff, but making money out of it. For example, the first thing I've made money out of was drawing graffiti for money. So I was passionate about graffiti, part of a high school group, not to say gang, but we were rollerblading, skating in Ploiești. We were drawing graffiti, and that's illegal, obviously. So we said, so it's illegal. We're running from the police. We're spending our own money on spray cans. Why not try to do it differently? So we went to some places that we knew around the high school. Basically, it was the computer bar at that moment. It was really
internet cafe.
And we drew the outside and the inside, and we got money for that. And then it was a bread factory and shop. Again, it had a very bad look on the outside, and we drew their brand sort of when with some breads, and I think, and we got some money. Then we realized that okay, the lifestyle that we had, which was hip hop, R&B and rap driven.
Okay,
so we loved that. We were dressing with baggy clothes, but baggy clothes in Romania at that moment meant just getting a larger size of your pants and t-shirt or hoodie, because you didn't have the brands that we saw in all the music videos on MTV and VH1. So we said, okay, let's learn to do that. We knew how to draw. So it was, we went into a clothing design workshop for some weeks to understand how to literally create clothing. Then we chose a small factory, a small material suppliers, and we sort of created a brand of baggy hip-hop clothing here, but it wasn't a company.
Yeah, but it's so cool and interesting. And just to frame it a little bit, I guess this was happening back in the early 2000s or 90s, late 90s.
Yeah.
And I think that everything that you guys did organic just mimics a business at the end of the day, because you were doing branding.
Yeah.
You were making your own clothes.
Yeah.
And you were going towards monetizing something that was illegal. And all those things are internal in you. And just like you mentioned, I guess you inherited from your family. So that's something interesting to look at from the point of view of a businessman, right?
It is interesting with my family, because after that, when I was finishing high school, so going to university, my mother was already an entrepreneur. So she was employed, but then she started her own company in the same domain. So consultancy in regards to HR and risk assessment and stuff like that. But she tried other stuff too. So she tried at some point to get a, together with two partners, a banking franchise, which you would think it's something big, which is not. It was very easy to get into. It was the moment when foreign banks came to Romania and started creating their networks. So they were franchising that.
I realized the offices, right?
Yeah, the offices.
Okay.
So it was a very small investment, but it was a lot of work. It didn't work out for her, so she went. She went out of that partnership quite early. But I remember I was in high school and I was working with her when I could, with my sister, to understand what's happening there. So it was quite organic. And since that moment happened, she's been an entrepreneur. My father is more like, let's say, a freelancer now. So he's very specialized in audit and QA, QC at industrial level, but he's working as a freelancer, so not quite an entrepreneur, but still very, I would say he has his sort of freedom, but he's very disciplined with that. So he's using it the right way. Yeah, I think you're right. And I had a lot of examples. If I think about it, it might not seem that it came from the family, but the roots are definitely there.
I was just looking to pinpoint what are the skills that you actually need and how do you get to them? Because sometimes you inherit them, you see them in your family, around your group, around your friends, and they inspire you. Sometimes it comes out of suffering and you become a strong person due to all that hard context. Especially here in Eastern Europe, we see that a lot of times. But it was really, for me, it was really interesting to hear about that number, you know, 20 plus projects. I mean, it takes a lot. It actually takes a lot. It takes a lot of courage and facing failure. I think that's another point that's really important. We always hear about keeping the vision and keeping the course and being positive and optimistic and all that, but grassroots, it's not that easy, and not anyone can actually be a entrepreneur or a startup founder. You actually need some skills and also some emotional, readiness, or I don't know how to call it exactly. I think you have those two skills. And if you would like to choose one that actually helps you manage to go through that process, to overcome all those milestones in those projects, what would you say that skill is?
Ooh, that's not an easy question. I was just thinking about what you said earlier about the suffering, and I was thinking just the other day, I was talking to my wife we have a baby boy, so he's three years old, and you cannot stop comparing. Even if you want to, we are in touch with all the new stuff regarding parenting and stuff. But you look at your kid and you look at other kids and you see good stuff and you see some stuff that you would probably like to change and so on. But something struck me. It was about my childhood, and I've been very fortunate. So I had no big problems with my family. I had no big challenges. No big challenges. I mean, we went through a period when my parents had very bad financial situation, but they still did everything they could for us. And that was so, I think, encouraging. So they were getting loans just for us to get good food and clothing and stuff. I don't know how many people would do that.
You would be surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's something that it was tougher for them. They didn't put it on us at all. So what I realized is that I asked myself about this thing in particular. Was there suffering in my past that made me resilient in the current days? And the truth is, it was, but it wasn't external. And I realized that I was always more shy and introvert and scared of everything when I was a kid, but I wanted to be different. I don't know where that comes from, but I when I was bullied, for example, this probably are the biggest psychological challenges still, remembering the bullying. So I wasn't a tough person. I wasn't big. I was always skinny. But I always wanted to be more. So in the first years, it happened that, unfortunately, I became sort of a bully because I talked well and I was very manipulative and convincing. So I managed to generate a lot of attraction and people around me who supported me. Then I realized that's not the way I want to do stuff. But I think that transformed into creating teams eventually. But it did happen also from not suffering and frustration in my case. So there is a rooting in that. Tough to see it because but it's true. It's I think we need to find, to come back to your question, to your direct question. Not sure if it's a skill, but it surely is a driver. So if you're fair to yourself, especially when you grow older and more mature, you can look backwards and understand what worked for you. Was it a stick? Was it a carrot? Was it a mix between the two? What percentage? In what way? So in different times of my life, it was carrot and stick. But I need to admit that the stick worked. So when I wanted something very badly and I didn't have it, and I felt that without it I will be suffering, I did my best to get that.
Do you think that sometimes I believe that human potential is huge and it can be unlocked through events. In the examples that you gave me, do you think that the ability of having not manipulating but knowing how to talk, did that shape your commercial skills, your sales skills? Yeah. Did that trigger something in you that you actually used later on in your
Absolutely.
Life?
Absolutely. I realized that quite early, that I could express myself quite convincing and that I could drive action around me when needed. That happened in school, in projects, that happened in convincing teachers or professors of some things that I wanted. I can give you an example that I used to be very proud of. Now it seems silly, but I only failed during my university years, only failed one exam. So I got a 4. I just wrote an email, and I still have that email. I wrote an email to the teacher expressing that I know exactly what I wrote there. I appreciate the process of assessing my work, my thesis there, but I am sure that it was at least a 6, because I know I answered good at that one and at that one and at that one. And so I kind of summarized everything. It was a very convincing email, and I got a 5. So she changed my grade to a 5 without any formal process. It was just an email, a well-written email. So that obviously gave me the confidence that I can do more with that I can gather good people around me, convince clients. It sounds silly now because I used it sort of in the wrong manner, although it wasn't necessarily the wrong manner, because I was sure I deserved it at least 5. So I felt it was not right to get a 4. But it was a bit my ego was growing with this kind of small successes. And that at some moments was so big that I consider myself invincible. Then I fell down quite hard multiple times. I think I'm now better at it, but it still happens to consider that I can do anything.
Cool. Super, super, super cool. I mean, I get this energy from you that you are driven by beliefs, and you are driven by maybe vision. And let's see if we can point that out later on. I want to move a little bit on the context of your present business. Because speaking about skills, that's also a very important factor in success, in measuring success and actually achieving success. You are a startup in a not so technical, let's say, context or industry, at least here in Romania. Now, obviously, you have the abilities to convince people, but I would love to know about your business profile and how did you think about starting your company here in Romania at first? Because I guess this is the playground where you deploy your first time, let's say, business. And how was that for you? How was that? I don't know. How did you break the ice?
Well, fast forward from high school, in 2008, I started my software development / web design company with some friends. Fast forward 2008 to 2019, we were recovering after a very tough time with bad managerial decisions. So we had some debts, but we were recovering out of that. When an opportunity came, one of my friends said, okay, you should participate in the first PropTech hackathon organized in Southeastern Europe. I said, no, that's silly. We don't think that real estate is ready for technology. They're doing just fine. They're growing. He said, you should go there, especially because you're working with some technologies that they would need. He was mentioning the 3D part that we were already using in other types of projects. He said, okay. We went there, we did what we knew to do very well from the agency, which was understanding the current needs, the asks, and putting tech on top of that. It's always a matter of, I always say this, it's a matter of doing 3 stuff with technology, and I think with business in general, it's bringing them more money, especially if you're B2B. So I'm referring to B2B and especially enterprise, bringing them more money, optimizing costs and other resources, and awareness or vanity, or putting them in front of their competition. So we knew how to do that as a process. We went to that hackathon, we chose the leasing challenge, we won that, we won the main event, and that's, I had a, like a an aha moment when I said, this is it. We've been trying in parallel with the agency to support other ideas, other projects. Everything failed because we were trying in parallel. I think the universe is trying to tell us something. It's the moment to burn your bridges and your ships and to just go with this one. No matter what happens, just go with this one and you will end up somewhere better. But focus on just one industry. And initially we thought one product, now we are multi-product, which is better for us, but it's still very focused. So we started Bright Spaces in 2019. We gave ourselves April to September, October, we gave ourselves two quarters to sell what we had in the agency to pay the debts. So we sold our portfolio and part of the team. So we placed part of the team to ZTech.
Okay.
So we ended that. We managed also to go to a lot of pitching events. So we raised our pre-seed round, €185,000 from Sparking Capital, Grow Chanwe, and Ilinka Pauna as an angel. So we chose some real estate angels, obviously, because we had no real estate knowledge at that moment. It was the only way to do it. So we kept three of our colleagues, myself, my partner, Andre, the CTO and co-founder. And it was like that. So it wasn't such a big, from my perspective, it wasn't a big vision. It wasn't a big idea. It was something like we saw and we saw the opportunity. The biggest asset class in the world, real estate, is the least digitized. We saw how we sparked interest in just 48 hours. We managed to convince not just to win the challenge, there were six challenges, but also the main event with an national and international jury. So big companies, really big companies. And we said, we can do this. We can do it in 4 or 5 years. We can create a global company with a huge success, a unicorn. We have a unicorn right here. So it wasn't like that. So 4 years already passed. We're not a unicorn. We're still on that path, but it will take another 7 to 10 years probably because of how slow the market is going. But it's going there.
Okay. Did you, by the way, about the market, did you realize at that time when you had the aha moment and you said, okay, this is it, this is what I'm going to focus on. Did you have in mind that, especially in this type of industry, there's a, it's really economical driven and you have highs and you have lows. And that obviously will impact your business. Did you look at that before you started and before you thought about deployment?
Absolutely not. We had no idea.
So it was only the trigger for you at the end of the day was the fact that it was less digitalized than other industry and it was a huge one?
It was. So what we saw was that it was a huge one. It was missing an elementary thing, which was pre-visualizing future spaces. We were doing that well enough at that moment. There was not a lot of competition, almost at all. So very, very scattered. All the competition was at our level or just one step ahead, not 10 steps ahead. So if I consider my thought process at that moment, our thought process, very similar to how VCs look at it, early stage VCs, I had no idea it was like that, but we looked at the market potential.
Okay.
We looked at the team. Is the team able to execute on that? We looked at competition. Is it a very crowded vertical or not? We looked at like in initial steps and we had the winning of the hackathon and we could monetize that somehow. Then it happened with another hackathon with Skanska in October and we could monetize on that. So we started gathering some small, let's say initial badges, which we said, okay, this is interesting. If it's growing, even if it wasn't financially, it was growing. So we said, this is it. This is the ship that we need to jump onto.
Okay. Obviously, from idea to deployment, it's a different thing. And I was wondering how was it at the beginning? When you started, when you started reaching out, partnerships, when you started talking about your value proposition, of course, with potential clients. How was that path? Especially when we're talking about startups, there's pressure. And we will talk about pressure. Please expand a little bit on that. Because there's a lot of potential entrepreneurs that are listening to us. And I think this is a very important moment that breaks a lot of new potential businesses due to weird decisions. Would you like to expand a little bit on that, please? Yeah.
I'm laughing because one of my biggest learnings in these 4 years was understanding, and by the way, I'm still sometimes failing at this, understanding that the founder's role is to, within the team, to always put an emphasis on the vision, the long-term game, impossible made possible, over-promising all the time. Like, we need to break the rules. We need to be the best. We need to, but then it's the same person who needs to be more pragmatic with investors, and he needs to hopefully under-promise and overachieve. I failed badly at this because I did the same for both, which was selling the vision, like the big vision. And for the first years, I failed on every promise that I've made. Now, if you look at it, all the promises were extremely big. So the business didn't fail. I failed in front of my investors. And that was probably the biggest, let's say, setback for myself. I last year was really tough on this part because I felt that I failed them, even though the business was running well and we still grew 2 times, but I promised 10 times. So, so initially, this is something that, again, to answer your question, is it was normal to dream big, and it was normal to think that the impossible will be possible. But we should have kept that inside and be more pragmatic on the outside.
That's a very valuable lesson. And I would like to touch a little bit on 2023. You mentioned it was a very hard year. And I would like to start from, how did you manage to, I don't know, I guess, mitigate the expectations that you projected and the fact that you didn't achieve them, in maintaining a good relationship with the investors and keeping them on board? I think that's not easy to do.
Yeah.
And also the fact that you have to be dual a little bit, in the sense that you need to have the right leadership, the right soft skills to communicate the vision, and that you're breaking the walls and with your team. And then you have to have another type of speech in order to keep the investors on board and helping you also from the smart money perspective, not on the money perspective, because that's not enough. Mentorship, I think, is really valuable. And we talked also about that cameras.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Don't know exactly how I did it. I just know that when times were rough, I did have some of them, not all of them, but some of them supporting us no matter what, because they knew us as people. They knew us as a team. They knew us as results, but from the inside. So they were quite close, and they were encouraging, and they were saying, okay, so you learn your lesson. You need to be more pragmatic. Now let's get back to execution. So you don't need to stay there for long when it's dark. I always had coaches, advisors, mentors around me, and most of them from the investment part. And that helped a lot. So one advice would be to, if you can be very close to your investors, because it's a long-term commitment and journey. And then when I realized this, I just did this with all of them. It worked perfectly with the majority, maybe not with all of them, but with I said, okay, this is it. So we wanted 10x, we didn't get 10x. We just got 2x, which was great in a downturn, but from the promise to the achievement, it wasn't that great. And we said, let's reshape everything and make it so that we from now on, we're more pragmatical and in touch with reality. So let's look at the business plan again. We needed to go through a contingency plan. So we dropped costs with 40%. We needed to we lost some people in the process. So it wasn't easy, but it was the right thing to do because the company is way healthier now. And it wasn't easy. And support was very, very important. And the team, what can I say? The team, the majority of the team is still here.
Okay, so I guess this is what they mean when VCs look at the team and the people, because the bets are on the people. And it gets real when it gets real.
Yeah.
So I think on your webpage that you are a VC-backed startup. Obviously, we know that because Fortech Investments plays a role in that backing up and trust. What's the difference between the VC path and a non-VC path?
Startup?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on what you're doing. But right now, in the current market, with all the markets, all the sub-markets moving so fast and iterating so much, I would say that the VC mentality starts to be deployed into everything. Even if you don't call it that, you will see a lot of very traditional businesses right now who are getting angels, and not your traditional tech angel. I'm not referring to that. People with money getting a fraction of the company, so not majority of the company, to support that for the future. Even if that business cannot scale to unicorn, it can only scale locally, and it can. But the mentality of the VC is spillovered all over the business environment, and the differences were bigger 10 years ago. 10 years ago, you could choose to have either a lifestyle business or something with few people giving you a good salary on the long run, loving what you do, and that was it. You could do VC tech because it was only tech in VC at that moment, or you could try to do something locally or regionally that could scale, like a production industry, but you needed partners with money at that moment. But in the majority of cases, whoever had the money had the majority of the stake. And I think now is different. So imagine anything that you want to do, like if you want to do the best ice cream right now, and you have good recipes, and you have you have charisma, and you can generate your first location in your neighborhood and good ice cream. Then, because everything is so easy to copy right now, if someone who has a bit of money or a bit of knowledge to get some money from other people, maybe some friends in some marketing agencies, they can do that right away and scale faster than you and deploy 3 or 5. And close you. Yeah, so that's why you will see, even in hospitality, even in food, a lot of small companies getting money from angels, some even from VCs. Because in order not just to grow faster, but not to die, you need funding because others are doing that. So I think it's a peer pressure. So I think the differences between VC-backed or non-VC-backed are getting smaller. If you look at companies who are not VC-backed and big right now, it's okay. They lived in other times. I'm just talking about what starts right now.
Okay.
So I believe from an educational, entrepreneurial educational perspective, I think We should be in all universities and even high school and so on, teach kids and young entrepreneurs that this type of support, so smart money, which means a fraction of the company is being given to someone for capital and knowledge, can be adapted to almost everything. But it needs to be patient capital, not like in tech, where in 7 years you need to generate an exit. It can be for 20 years.
Sure. I actually read something interesting that's linked a little bit to what you said, that we need to set up capital since we are from the moment that we're born. And I heard about like around 7,000 euros, if you have, or dollars, if you have, and then put them in the market. Until you reach the age of 60, that amount will reach to around 1 million.
Okay.
Just invested, you know. So also in terms of talking about infrastructure in the educational space, yeah, we, especially here in Romania, we need to be more aware and more educated about financing and about, I don't know, investment. But on a true level, not what's going on right now. Because we see a lot of gurus talking about financing, and that I think it's not the right thing to do at this moment. And we should be aware of where the, I don't know, really true, let's say, advices come from.
Maybe there's not a single rule. Like maybe there's something for someone. That's so some guru appropriate for some type of investor. I think people who are interested in that right now will find a lot of good sources.
Of course, there's a lot of good for
whoever is looking for fast earnings will be in for a disappointment.
Unfortunately, that's where they tap in.
Yeah.
Making money fast, and we already know that making money fast is not something so generic. It's really hard. You were able to align VCs and angels in a manner that's really, really cool for Romania. Did you plan that ahead?
Yes and no. Meaning from the first round. So the way we envisioned the first round of funding, when we wanted to exit the agency, we said, okay, we failed a lot of projects, so 20 plus projects, because we tried to do it our way, the way we saw in the media, like entrepreneurship in parallel, multiple businesses and so on. So we failed. And we said, okay, if we failed with everything until now, or mostly fail with everything until now, the way to start right space is we need to think differently. So we went back to the drawing board and to 101 of VC-backed companies. So I've read all the well-known angels and VCs locally and internationally and Silicon Valley's blogs, how they're looking at stuff. And one of the first lessons that we got out of that was it's not common in a pre-seed round to have VC, it's usually just angels, but it's even more uncommon to have a mixed group. Like in our case, it was an early stage VC, sparking capital, a group of angels, but not just some angels put together. It was a very like an institutional group of angels, Grouchanu, and Dilin Capăun as an individual angel. So we had from the first round three types of investors with different sort of thesis and with different things to bring to the table on top of the money. I'm referring to. So Sparking had already LPs, so we could tap into their LPs, especially in the real estate. Grouchanu had angel network. Adi is a real estate person. Ilinka is a real estate person, but also Entrepreneurship Academy. So we looked at all the things that we could get out of that, and I think we did a good job in mixing that. We could have probably just gotten Sparking and one angel, or just Sparking. It was possible, but we said we need to make it a mixed round. And after we saw how successful that was for us, we just scaled that. So at seed round, we got two Western European funds, Accelio and Pylabs, follow on from our existing investors, but also another big group of angels, especially real estate people. Most of them at their doing their first investment. So they weren't the regular tech angels, but they were interested in what we were building for the real estate industry. And now in our third round, we managed to bring other funds like Fortech, like Helen's Rock, like Clearance in London. So new funds. But again, it's a very mixed, very, very diversified round. And I think for us, that went extremely well. I know there are rules that said don't break your cap table too much. We didn't yet have any problem with that. It might be, but there are multiple ways of handling that when that situation can arise. We're discussing actively with Series A investors, and nobody had any problems with our cap table structure. So I think the mixed rounds are the future.
Nice. Would you say that there were no problems with the cap table because of that mix, that, and the value that the mix brought in terms of growth?
I think there was no real problem with our cap table because everyone came with additional value. So we selected whoever joined. So not that we selected, because it wasn't a startup market. It was still an investor market, but we managed to bring together the people who believed in us, the product, the vision, the market potential. So they are always very interested in helping. And I love that. So I get phone calls out of our normal reporting and meetings and the normal process. I always talk to investors and they're trying to help. They see a post on LinkedIn, they immediately say, okay, I think I can help you with that, or do you need help with that? And so it's really good to have this pool of relevant people and knowledge to tap into.
I don't want to play devil's advocate, but if you flip the coin, so this is the good side, but in your process of growing and expanding your business, will it be challenging for you to manage discussions with a mix of stakeholders? Would you say that would be, I don't know, a little bit difficult?
Well, I think every period in time in the lifespan of a company has his way of interacting with your investors. Right now, we need a lot of help yet. So we're very happy that this happens, that we have a lot of conversations with all of them. I'm talking about in total some tens of people. So if you put the all the funds plus the angel groups, plus the LPs that we have access to some LPs, it's a lot of. I'm not talking to everyone, but I'm open to talking to everyone. So I never said no to anyone, and I think it's the right thing to do. Now, after Series A, after Series B, I think I haven't been there, but I expect things to change, because the structure of the decision making process will be changed. Right now, we have an official board, which is light, so it's just three members and one board observer, so that's really easy to handle from that perspective. Everything else is because both parties want that to happen. In the future, that might change from the time perspective, but I think everyone will be happy to have invested into a successful company that reached a certain level. And okay, we're not talking to them as much as we did before, but it's growing. They have the new US VC as a lead in Series A, so they're on good hands. I don't see that as a problem.
Sure. I wanted to ask you that because you need to manage a lot of stakeholders, and that's not something easy. And it doesn't matter the stage that you are in. When it comes to dealing with people, you know how it is. There's a dynamic to all that. But it also comes back to the skills that you have. And I think that you're doing a great job, but it also suits you really well. There's something that I also want to touch on a little bit. Also because I have a background in startups and I understand the importance of the team and the importance of the company profile. And we were talking about defining what you are. Are you a product-driven company? Are you a marketing-driven company or a sales-driven company? I would like to know, in your story, of course, when did that awareness came to life from your perspective? When did you realize that's important in terms of how you're choosing your team and how you're choosing your deployment tactics and all that? And how did you discover that, let's say, aha, Eureka moment? And yeah. If it's, of course, and do you think it matters when it comes to building new companies?
Yeah, it matters a lot. We realized that too late, not too late, but very late in the process. Only last year, I think it was really embedded into our new strategy. Why this matters is because if you believe you will build a company, so a tech startup, where you will have 2 years to be in stealth mode in R&D, to work with a team of 5, 7, 10 people, not talking to anyone, just building on the product. And then in 2 years, you'll have a Steve Jobs presentation moment on a big stage where you'll present your product. I think that rarely happens. I think the product-led companies are rare. The true product-led companies are rare. They usually happen with serial entrepreneurs with successful experience in startuping and with exits. So they know exactly how to overcome the initial struggles. So they have cheat codes, let's say, because they are already 40, 45. You will see this in US a lot. How fast it is for some founders to get to a really good position with a new company because they know the drill. And I think the majority of early stage startups, especially in Eastern Europe, will be sales driven. What that means for me is that investors who are putting any type of any ticket into you will expect revenue very fast. And you need to imagine what that means. That means that you will never have the time to build what's in your head. You will all only have the time to build what's sellable. That's a bummer for the majority of founders, because we want to create great products, shiny and with big chunks of deep tech and so on, when the market is only ready to buy simple stuff. So you will be disappointed that you need to do stuff that's more simple, easier to sell, but you have the fiduciary duty to your investors to grow the MRR, to make them to multiply the valuation of the company until the next round comes. And I think you need to understand that. So for me, now it's clear how it should be handled. It wasn't clear 4 years ago. I had no idea how it will be. But it's very clear that depending on the market you're starting in, depending on the market that you're targeting, depending on the initial team skills, on the money that you have or don't have and you need additional funding, how you will be in that pressing need to sell the product or not. Because that will drive your entire strategy.
Would you say that when you need to internationalize your business, that's a little bit of a problem, especially when we look at the Romanian startup landscape? We've seen struggles in this area. I guess now having a mix of investors at your side, that would be helpful. But how do you do the transition?
Not sure that there's a one recipe to suit all. A lot of investors will tell you aim for another market from the beginning and that will be easy. In our case, it was Romania and the UK because we were part of PyLab's acceleration program. So this brings me to a suggestion, an advice. Make sure that you get accepted early on into a world level, a global level accelerator, because that will open some stuff that you won't have locally. So if you can go for, even if you cannot aim for international investors from the beginning or clients, but you can aim for accelerators. The only thing that you need to provide for that to happen, of course, the pitch should be good, the team should be good, the market should be big enough, but you should be able to articulate your product and your solutions and your future strategy as a global product. So you shouldn't base your assumptions or only on what you see locally. And that's the tough part, because you only have access to that. In order to get into an international accelerator, you need to show a global mindset, but you don't have that global mindset because you are only playing here in the first months. So how do you do that? I think it's also a bit of luck, a bit of good PR, selling yourself better at what you can do, even if you're not doing it right now. Politics, using your existing angels to support you. And so, yeah.
There's always a elevator pitch or a sales pitch or a value proposition when you're at the idea stage and when you are after you have deployed your business after the MVP. How would you articulate your value proposition now? Really short.
That's interesting because I have a few of them for different audiences. And that's another thing that changes and you should be very aware of. At the beginning, you will only have one because your initial idea is to get investors. So it will be an investment elevator pitch or USP that you can articulate. But after you start having clients or even partners, like channel partners to sell, you will need to say a few words about the company. Or even when you're in hiring mode, you will need to say different things in a few words to convince the other person that they should continue talking to you. So my question would be for you, for whom? Who am I talking to? If I'm talking to an investor, I can tell you. If I'm talking to a potential client, I will tell you a different thing that I'm saying.
If you were to look at the core of what you're doing, who would you address with the value proposition, and what would that value proposition sound like?
Well, right now for us, the most important thing is obviously getting new clients. So I would go, if I would only be able to choose one person or one audience to pitch to, I would definitely pitch to clients. And I will tell them that it's the first time in their history when they're able to get faster leases up to 30% to optimize their marketing architecture and sales costs and resources with up to 25%, and to get up to 10 times more tours for their spaces by using Brightspace's 3D technology.
Awesome. One last thing, and thank you so much for being present here.
Thank you.
It's something that I read. It was a quote of yours, and it sounded like this. The founding rounds for Bright Spaces can fit into two categories. They have been challenging, but have also brought the greatest satisfactions. The emotions you go through in a few months of fundraising are hard to explain. Nothing can prepare you for them. You have to go through the process step by step, from pitches to negotiations and discussions with lawyers. You have to learn to control your emotions, because otherwise you can risk damaging relationships. How do you control the emotions?
When did I say that? I don't know.
It's something that I actually translated it from Romanian to English. But
it's really true. Like I identify with that totally.
Obviously, because they are your words and they sound really, really nice. Emotions.
Emotions.
I wanted to also talk about this subject because I have seen huge potential, huge startups that could have gone to amazing status, at least in my assessment. But I saw that emotions played a huge role. Interaction with the funders, with the VCs, interaction with the customers. You can be your own enemy. And this was really interesting for me, at least. I mean, I understand how you can risk damaging relationships, and I understand how certain moments play a huge role in what you're building, and you can be your own biggest enemy. How do you keep calm, and how do you manage those situations which come with, I mean, I think it's really important that you have contextual awareness, first of all, and have a bird's eye view. How do you do that, actually? How do you have that bird's eye view, and how do you understand those emotions and those voices inside you and the role they play?
Again, I don't think there's a one solution fits all. For me, it was my own journey of self-awareness and understanding myself, which started quite early. So when when I was in university, I started looking at myself from a spiritual perspective with different practices, meditation, yoga, movements, simple stuff like running.
I know you're passionate about running.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that help?
A lot. I can give you an example. I received a sort of a bad news some days ago, and I was so initially so furious at the situation, not the person or myself. It's just like I didn't mitigate this right. I don't know why I did it, but I was furious, and I was in a, let's say, self a destructive mode because I was dark, and I just said, okay, I'm just going to run for a bit. And I ran for 25 minutes. It changed everything. Like I managed to mitigate the outcome, to understand it can happen in multiple scenarios, and if there's something to do, I'll do it. If there's nothing to do, it is what it is. So but that comes after many, many years of failing at doing that. Another thing that helps me a lot is having coaches, advisors that I trust. I would trust my life to them, and I listen to them very carefully, and I try to put into practice a lot of the things that they say. And I think it's, as for every human being, it's an evolution.
Thank you, Bogdan, so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
I think you are an amazing human being. And
the same, thank you.
I also believe that you will reach amazing milestones in your business and also as a person. I only got good energy from you. You are really sharp and on point, and that says a lot about you. And it was really an honor for me to have this discussion. And also the fact that you tapped a little bit in the emotional side, that says a lot about you. And thank you for sharing so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having this podcast. And I look forward to the next episode.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.